You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 5th to the 11th of June 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump and writers Jack Grove and David Matthews. A journal's editorial board has been left on the brink of resignation after an 8-month standoff with its publisher. Find out why in just a moment. Some US universities have been labelled desperate and are expected to turn to private for profit firms in a bid to get more international students through their doors, according to a recent analysis. David has more on that in a second. And longer, more frequent strikes could be on the cards. That's following the University and College Union Congress in Manchester last month. Jack was there and he'll have a report coming up shortly. But first, to you, Paul. What has left a journal's entire editorial board on the cusp of resigning?
A ham-fisted attempt at censorship is the answer that one person gives to that. But yeah, the story is that last September, an edition of a journal called Prometheus, subtitled Critical Studies and Innovation, was due to be published. It's a Taylor & Francis journal, but it didn't appear. And its academic editor eventually received a letter from Taylor and Francis explaining why, and that the reason was that the journal was running a debate on academic publishing and specifically the sort of levels of profits that the commercial firms typically make. None of the stuff was particularly new, but it was quite sort of stridently stated. There was a proposition paper which was sort of very critical of the publishing industry, and then there were four responses, some of which were equally critical and others were more supportive. But it seems that Taylor and Francis didn't like the idea of the journal having a debate on academic publishing at all.
I wonder why. I wonder why that could be.
Perhaps come on to that in a minute. But anyway, they said they weren't going to publish this edition, which was already late by the time this conversation occurred, unless that proposition paper was cut by more than half, getting on for 2/3. The editors refused and all threatened to resign unless Taylor and Francis backed down. It did back down in January, but the edition didn't actually appear until the end of last month. According to the editor of the journal, the publisher was hoping the whole issue would just go away. But he took the course of withholding all future editions of the journal until that one appeared. So in the end, the publisher basically had no choice if it wanted any further issues of the journal to publish the one about academic publishing.
So is that? It's all resolved, everyone's satisfied and the board will stay in place? Or are they,
No, not at all. I mean, one thing that everybody's upset about is a disclaimer that's appeared on all the articles, basically warning readers not to trust the content. That was imposed without the editor's consent or indeed knowledge. The editor says that, you know, trust between him and the editorial board and the publishers now sort of at rock bottom, and he doesn't quite see how they can go on. He says they're all considering their position, and you know, one option would be to resign en masse and set up a rival journal, although they haven't made that decision yet, but it wouldn't be entirely unprecedented if they did.
This sort of brings to mind the image of like King Canute, really, doesn't it? The sort of publisher trying to stop debate about their business model and the accusation that they basically just cream off money from academic work by actually just stopping that debate even happening in their own journals. But I mean, is that a good analogy? I mean, you know, will the sort of tide of open access eventually change, do you think? But I mean, you know, will the publisher's model be, you know, will it be phased out?
Well, I think, it is a valid analogy in that this debate is raging, you know, all over the place, and you can shut it down in one, you know, academic journal. But, you know, clearly these are points that lots of people make. You know, there's a boycott of Elsevier at the moment. You know, Tim Gowers, the mathematician, is very active in all of this. So, you know, this debate is happening. It's not really about open access. And part of the criticism, actually, in that proposition paper is that the whole open access debate and specifically the Finch report didn't really address the issue of publishers' profits. And, you know, David Willetts, you know, specifically wanted a solution to open access that would essentially preserve the status quo regarding publishers' profits. So, you know, in that sense, the issue is still there. It's clearly, you know, a very live and sensitive one, and you know, the debate will go on.
Mm. Well, page 6 and indeed 7 to hear a bit more on that debate in this specific instance. But David, we'll move on to your story now. So companies that recruit and prepare international students for university are pretty well known in the UK, into university partnerships, study group, two such examples. Your report sort of looks at suggestions that the US might be about to see a proliferation of this sort of activity. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And as you say, this is a pretty common sight on campuses across the UK. A for-profit company, often owned by sort of private equity, getting international students' English and study skills up to speed in the foundation year. And there's been elements of controversy, but it's kind of swept the UK pretty quickly within about, you know, the past decade or so. But there's an analysis by a consultancy, OC&C, which they've kindly shared with us, which shows that there are quite a lot of universities in the US who are looking to do similar things. I mean, the US obviously has, over the past, since the financial crisis, has had some pretty serious cutbacks to its state and federal higher education budgets. And one way to plug the gap, of course, is international students who, you know, among other things, are financially lucrative for universities. And it found that there is a strong interest from nearly one in five US universities surveyed, and they think, you know, the medium term, so sort of 3 to 5 years, you know, every year there will be an extra 10,000 students coming through this pathway route. And in particular, the kind of regional universities, no, not the sort of top-ranked universities, but the kind of regionally decent ones are looking to go through this route, basically for financial reasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, your report opens with the word desperate, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
It's quite easy in the UK often to say when the cash flow seems to be running a little bit dry, the default sort of position of your university looking to boost it is to look to get more people from overseas, isn't it?
There are many idealistic people in universities who value international students for reasons other than the cash flow. But if you're looking at the finances, yes, I mean that's pretty much the main reason for recruiting international students. I mean, it just shows that this kind of model, this kind of for-profit private aspect to higher education, is moving into the US from the UK, and probably will do. I mean, particularly into a really now kind of gunning for the US, because the UK is basically saturated as a market. Although, an extra 10,000 a year international students sounds like a lot, but there were 340,000 international students undergraduates enrolled in 2012-13. So it's actually...
That's in US, is it?
Yeah. I mean, in the US. I mean, the point OC&C are making is, it sounds like a lot, but actually it's probably less than some people are predicting. So there's lots of fears that you could have if US universities suddenly try and really recruit international students, because at the moment they have about 3% international students, UK is about 12%, and if they go from 3% to 12%, you know, it could really sort of wipe out the UK and Australia in terms of their international student recruitment. But
I've heard it said that California is thinking about this because they would be ostensibly a really easy place to market for students, because they've got loads of great universities, but they have, you know, they've got a bit of money trouble, but they don't have all that many foreign students, and it'd be pretty easy to say come to California rather than come to, I don't know, the Midlands.
Careful.
Or
yeah.
You know, so yeah, you know, if they got their act together, they could really.
Yeah, I think the University of Southern California, unless I'm mistaken, has more
international students than any other US university. I'm not sure if that's as a percentage or an actual figure, but I know that they have
dozens
that.
Of universities that could do that in California, and they do really well.
I suppose the one difference between the UK and the US though is that in the US you can make as much money from an out-of-state student as you can an international student, because they basically pay full fees. They pay the full economic cost of, well, the full price, as it were, of studying there. So, you know, if you're from California, you can, you know, you might as well recruit someone from Idaho as much as in India. It's the same economic benefit, so there's not quite the same incentive.
Interesting stuff. Well, from sunny California to Manchester, where you were, Jack, last week at the University and College Union Congress. What did you find out while you were up in the northwest?
Well, it rains a lot in Manchester.
I know that.
When
too
I
well.
Was when I was up there, it was a very interesting conference. There was a lot of internal strife, a lot of disagreements, particularly over the way the pay dispute had been handled this year. And there's basically in the UCU Congress every year, but more so this year, there's a clash between the sort of the moderates and UCU left. And some people were feeling that some sort of militant elements were unhappy about the way that UCU had handled it. They hadn't managed to improve upon the 1% offer. They got 2% for next year, but they hadn't got any more for this year. And lots of people felt that if they'd stuck with their original plan to call a marking boycott in January and, you know, really stick to that, then they could have got a much better deal. And there was actually a motion of censure, sort of not a motion of no confidence, but a motion to criticise the Higher Education Committee that handled the dispute on behalf of the union, and say that they mishandled it, and it was passed. So it's really strange. You had the new president who led the committee voting to censure the committee and saying that she thought it had been mishandled. So that sort of shows how divided the union is over this.
Yeah, but that's the union members who attended the conference, of course. I mean, I always find that curious about unions, whichever union it is. I mean, it's not a uniquely HE issue. I mean, I used to go to nursing union conferences in a previous role. I've been to teaching union events as well. And do you not find you tend to get quite a lot of the sort of maybe more hardline UCU members, you know, trekking to the conference to actually vote on these issues and ostensibly representing the union as a whole?
Well, this is what many people say. They say, when we do e-ballots and we ask the general membership what they want there, they've actually said, you know, we're happy with this deal, we'll take it. But the UCU left are saying, actually, these e-ballots are not the way we should decide. We should let the elected representative of Congress decide the union policy. And as they do tend to be a bit more left-wing, they've gone for some quite radical things. For instance, they voted to send a delegation to Gaza to look at the effect of the Israeli blockade, and maybe more moderate UCU members might think, actually, why are we spending thousands of pounds sending a group of people to look at something we can't really affect all that well, when that money could be spent, you know, helping
domestically.
Spent domestically. So there was lots of quite interesting things going on there, and a real division in the union.
Interesting. Well, page 10 and 11 for your write-up from Manchester. That's all for this week. I should flag up our cover feature before we go, which is the first of two pieces by Bradley Garrett, whose research, among other things, has taken him to the top of the Shard in London, not up the stairs, I should point out, as you or I might go up, or in the elevator. He scaled it while it was being built. And he's writing for us about research in legally sensitive areas. There's also some remarkable photography from Dr. Garrett in that piece too, which makes my hands go a bit sweaty just looking at it, actually. He seems to be perched in some pretty precarious positions. But that's also in this week's magazine. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed today, today, or indeed on anything that is covered in the magazine more generally, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. Lots of email addresses on there that you can get in touch with us via, as well as on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+. Please don't be shy, get in touch. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.